How's Phoenix today? Nice and warm.
Yeah.
Afternoon, Dr. Campbell.
Hi, Dr. Campbell. Dr. Sadlick, would you like me to take roll?
Yeah, let's do it so we can roll on, so to speak.
Okay. Dr. Sadlick?
Here.
Ms. Tibbetts? Ms. Gallen? Dr. Campbell?
Hi.
Dr. Spatt? Dr. Rubin?
Present. I'm missing three, we have four.
Dr. Popio, are you with us? Okay. Dr. Popio said he would be absent. I just wanted to be sure. Ms. Tibbetts? Ms. Gallen? Ms. Tibbetts?
This is Karen Tibbetts, yes.
Ms. Gallen? Ms. Gallen?
Brian McConnell here. Just joining.
Okay. Thank you. Ms. Gallen, are you with us?
We have quorum.
We do have quorum, yes.
It's Thursday, June 9th, 2022, 12 o'clock, Major Patrick Dunn Board meeting. We do have quorum. Legally with us today is Mr. Larson from the Attorney General's Office and our Executive Director, Ms. Gail Anthony. Roll call's been done. We'll move to number two, Declaration of Conflicts of Interest. We didn't get any, so I'm going to move on to three, which is a stability statement. In accordance with the open meeting law, the board has a stability policy that prohibits any confidential electronic disrupts the board from carrying out its business. Those violating this policy will be asked to modify their behavior and act civilly. If you do not act civilly, we'll disconnect you from the phone call. What I'd like to do is take four, 4A, and run that. I'm going to need the board's permission. Run 4A through 4T at the top.
Is Dr. Rubin so moved?
And we'll need a roll.
We need a second, please.
This is Rashad. I second that. I think Rubin did already.
Yeah, Rubin did.
Rubin made the motion, as I understood it, to approve the consent agenda for A through T, and Dr. Spatz seconded.
And roll call, please. Dr. Sadlick?
Aye.
Ms. Tibbetts? Ms. Tibbetts? Dr. Campbell?
Aye.
Dr. Spatt?
Aye.
Dr. Rubin?
Aye.
Ms. Tibbetts?
Aye.
And Ms. Gallen, are you with us? Okay. Motion carries.
4A through C, motion carries. I'm going to move on to number five, review consideration of possible action regarding the following board cases. We'll start off with board case number 22-219, and that's Dr. Brian McConnell. And this is his initial interview, and then Ms. Anthony will give us a background.
Okay. And Dr. Salek, members of the board, on 4/18 of 2022, the State of Arizona Naturopathic Physicians Medical Board received a complaint from FD, who alleges respondent treated his prostate cancer with high-dose estrogen therapy, causing him to experience a heart attack on 1/13/2022. According to FD, after suffering the heart attack, several attempts were made to contact respondent. 13 days later, respondent reached out, informing FD the phone call would be a billable phone consult. In his response to the board, dated 4/28/2022, respondent indicated FD presented to the clinic on 12/20/2021 with a history of reoccurrence of prostate cancer, with an initial presentation 5 to 7 years earlier, a second malignancy of genital organs, hyperlipidemia, and neuropathy. FD presented to respondent from referral by a naturopathic physician located in another state, included a previous outlined high-dose vitamin C IV treatment. According to the records, FD had already received two IVs at the clinic prior to the initial visit with respondent on 1/3/2022. Respondent brought up the treatment option of transdermal estradiol. Respondent admitted he had limited experience with E2 transdermally, metastatic prostate cancer. He had some success with a prior patient and had done his own research on the subject. Relating to the delay in the response to FD post-heart attack, respondent writes, quote, "Did not receive his first email informing us of the heart attack in a timely manner. Inadvertently, the front office staff about 1 week later notified me, after which I quickly responded. I'm sure this delay irritated him, and rightly so, but it was an inadvertent delay," end quote.
Is the complaint on the line?
I am.
Okay. We'll be referring you by just initials only today. I will hear from you first, Dr. McCall, and then we're going to hear from you. Okay.
Is there a specific question, or would you like me to, or would you?
Well, I give us a general overview like Ms. Anthony did, that would be helpful.
Okay, sure. So, regarding the, I think Gail already spoke about the inadvertent delay. So I definitely remember the day I walked into the clinic and the front desk staff told me, "Oh, we got this email about a week ago," and so that was, a mistake on their part, and we own that, of course. But I immediately reached out and sent the patient an email with which I think you have record of, and there's in your possession now. I think that one of the things I'd like to say is that while I only had one patient, I'm this way with patients. If I don't have a lot of experience with something, but I felt like there was efficacy, then I would share that with any patient that I have, whether it's a family member or a patient. We'd like to treat everybody like we want to be treated ourselves. And but I have done quite a bit of research on transdermal estradiol. The first time I heard about it was through Dr. Neil Rozier. I'm a member of AMMG, Age Management Medicine Group, and he had mentioned it in one of his lectures. I have attempted to reach out to him unsuccessfully. He puts on these lectures, and I've spoke to the clinic there a couple times. I guess he doesn't work in the clinic routinely, but rather puts on lectures, so it's been hard to get a hold of him. But there are many data linking high dose estrogen being just as efficacious as androgen deprivation therapy, except without the side effects of depleting estrogen in addition to testosterone. And the patient would probably tell you that I told him there'd be no reduction in testosterone. That isn't quite true. I as I recall, I would say I'm not sure how much your testosterone is going to go down, but it's probably not going to go down as much as androgen deprivation therapy, which I believe he got some 5 or 6 years ago in another state. I don't know how long he continued it. So I included a number of studies from which I derived not only how to administer. We're all very aware of the dangers of oral estrogen, right? Causing clots, especially venous, not so much heart attacks and the atherosclerotic process, but more venous thromboembolic events. But there is no increased risk of VTE with transdermal estradiol compared to oral estradiol. And one of the results I'll also refer to is the patch results, and where they looked at, 1,600 men with metastatic prostate disease, and the determination was that there was no increased risk for cardiovascular events compared with androgen deprivation therapy. So I see this coming as more of an emerging treatment, you know, even from the oncology point of view, although it is, you know, it's not definitely not mainstream medicine, has been used before. And I think that what has happened is that the newer drugs come out and they do studies and they show that they're more efficacious. So transdermal estradiol, or actually they were actually given it parenterally in some studies, just fell by the wayside. So when I heard this about the patient having an LAD blockage, right immediately in my mind, I made no connection with the transdermal estradiol. His levels at 100, that would be 100 picograms per mil, which I have several patients that are on hormone replacement therapy that run estrogens about the level that he had when he incurred the cardiovascular event that he did in January.
So I read your information you submitted, and was your thought process that you believed that the estrogen was going to basically act as a more subtle approach rather than Lupron or some of the other?
Yes, basically, right. And I had shared with the patient that this other patient I have, he's been on it about 2.5 years now. He has had not gynecomastia as a side effect, but kind of like some lower, like his feet would swell, but he took his PSA from 30 down to 1 in probably 2 months' time. And we did start to see a slight trend in this patient's PSA from, I want to say 58 to maybe 53 or 4, something like that. I could look it up, but it started to show a slight benefit. Yes, I was going to increase his dosing, but that would be based on his tolerability of the medicine. And so this other patient that I am treating with this for now for over 2 years is doing fine. And I actually have him on testosterone replacement now with a PSA less than 1.
And was your thought process with this particular case to some, I understand through the PSA, but what else were you going to use as a monitoring tool for his prostate besides PSA? Were you going to get him referred for ultrasound? Were you going to prosthetic ultrasound, MRI?
Yes.
Okay.
Well, basically, since he was traveling, you know, I did recommend he, you know, goes back to, you know, to the oncologist or the urologist to get monitoring, because he wasn't going to stay here for a month or two. But we were willing to give him referral here if he wanted. I mean, I just obviously there's the case whether what the patient wanted to do, and money was always an issue for them, and I think that was somewhat a limiting factor. I know that's not exactly peripheral to what you're saying there, But yeah, I mean, first and foremost, we already knew that, you know, the MRI from what was in the seminal vesicle involvement from the last MRI he had, which wasn't more than a year ago, I think. So as far as imaging, I didn't see any need to do anything rather quickly, but of course down the road MRI would be the preferred imaging.
Okay, and then getting into clotting, etc. You had already checked RBCs, you had checked platelets, you could have done PTT, etc., but the basics you had covered his RBCs, platelets, etc.
Yes, we have labs we got labs in January 7th we got CBC, CMP, and cholesterol, testosterone, estradiol, PSA, and prostate-specific prostate acid phosphatase. And then the next labs I got that was in January 7th, and then the next labs I got were February 27th, which was a follow-up with thyroid, since we had started him on some thyroid, PSA, testosterone, and a BNP, estradiol as well.
Okay. And how did, I went through your two items I have left, and I'll turn it over to the rest of the board. What was Morris's role in this? Did he come from Morris and refer to you, or you?
I'm not sure. I'm not sure why they chose us over Lance as far as IVs. They had already done a couple with him, and he was doing other IVs. Was it essential oils, I think, and phosphatidylcholine, and so. There, I have not spoken to Dr. Morris, so I think the patient was just, you know, maybe accessibility or what, I don't know.
Okay. And then, hold one moment, and then, because we're gonna allow you some time too. I just want to finish this with the doctor. And then my last question for you was, he was aware through i.e. waivers, et cetera, that the potentiation could be this, and that with estrogenic therapy?
Well, yeah, including, you know, the things I alluded to earlier, like gynecomastia, you know,
right,
swelling, you know, the fact that, you know, we're going to have more estrogen than usual.
Right.
And that obviously would adjust just therapy according to response and tolerability.
Okay. Was there anything in there about clotting or viscosity, blood, strokes, TIAs, blah, blah, blah?
You know, I do not distinctly remember mentioning that to him.
Okay. Let me turn it over, Dr. Calta, start off with Dr. Rubin, then I'm going to roll down the list there, then we'll get to the complaint. So, Dr. Rubin, let me turn it over to you.
This is Dr. Rubin. Hi, Dr. McConnell.
Hi.
Hey, remind me, but you have an ND and a DO after your name, right?
Correct.
I don't know how it goes, but do you have to choose which degree you use to write that prescription or how it's billed or something?
You know, I'm a bit of an unusual animal in that sense, in that I can't answer that directly. Obviously, there's things that I do, you know, EDTA, et cetera, of course, there's DOs that do that, but, I've never had a good answer on that, Dan, to know who I would be responsible to, shall we say. First and foremost, I feel like I have, you know, I'm attracted to a lot of patients in that I know the allopathic side of things, And obviously, I felt, you know, there was a deficit from that one as an Indy. But so I approach it. I still, you know, I'm coming with at mostly from the naturopathic perspective. It's difficult to answer that question.
Well, for this particular case, did you? I'm just wondering if you build this through insurance as a DO or an ND. I'm just trying to figure
out. We built, like the initial consult would go for, we have a naturopathic copay but we build insurance where possible. If I'm doing pellets on somebody or strictly, that obviously can't be billed to insurance. Vitamin C can't be billed to insurance. The Synexus treatment that we offered Forrest for his, lower extremity neuropathy was billed to insurance, but we have written that off because the patient did not want that to be billed.
Reminder to just use initials FD.
Yes, thank you.
To keep it anonymous. I'm trying to sort it out because I don't know, and I don't know if it's my business if this has been submitted to the DO board as well. But I'm sort of wondering, and I don't know if Mr. Larson, if you have a comment, if this office visit under which this was prescribed was not build through a naturopathic licensure, and if there's a way to sort that out, I think that might be an issue. I don't know. Mr. Larson, do we have any comments on that, or should I just drop the issue because we have a complaint support?
Yeah, Dr. Rubin, I would just say that the question, you know, in this, this complaint was submitted to the naturopathic board, and, you know, the board's prerogative is to decide whether this, you know, constituted, you know, was something he was doing within the scope of his naturopathic practice and whether it constitutes, unprofessional conduct in the course of his naturopathic practice. That would be the question. Does that answer or?
No, because if he prescribed it without his ND, then it's a moot point, it's irrelevant, and we're not adjudicating it. And the complaint was submitted to the wrong board. In my opinion.
Well, because I would say,
if you do it as an ND, then I can't judge that one way or the other because it's not for me to judge. So that's what I was trying to figure out. And I don't know if there is a separation or not. And that's what I was trying to figure out because I don't want to misspeak on behalf of the board.
Yeah. And I mean, again, Dr. Rubin, I guess what I was saying is that, you know, that decision would be sort of the board's prerogative to decide, you know, whether if this is something that the board does not feel that it falls within its scope of regulatory authority, then, you know, that could be, you know, but that's up to the board to decide. It was the only point I was making.
No, I understand. But how am I to decide what license he used to prescribe that? I mean, I would think if he billed the office visit to insurance as a DO, and that's the office visit where he made his prescription, and the ND copay was for something else, then he did not prescribe it using his naturopathic medical license. He prescribed it using his DO license. And so that's not for me to decide. That's for Dr. McConnell to tell us whether or not he did. Or if there isn't a distinction, then we continue.
Well,
in my opinion.
No,
I don't know, Dr. Sutherland?
The way I see Dr. Rubin is if he was to follow the quote standard osteopathic modalities, et cetera, we'll just look at it from standardized medicine point of view, then he would have given him Lupron and he would have done other, you know, therapeutics within that scope. But he didn't. He, you know, decided to utilize the estrogen, which is within our scope. So that's sort of my thought process.
Reasonable.
But I understand what you're saying.
Yeah.
But he could have prescribed Lupron injections for him and done it through that modality, which would have been more under his osteopathic license. However, he decided to utilize the estrogenic therapeutics, i.e. bioidentical hormone replacement therapeutics.
And that does express my viewpoint as well on that, Dr. Salen.
Okay. So that's kind of, okay. Dr. Rubin, where my thought process is. Yeah.
That makes sense. Okay, fine. No, I just needed to hear from Dr. McConnell, and so he just answered the question. So I'm curious, you were checking clotting markers or you weren't?
No, I did not do that with the first patient, nor did I do that with the FD.
And does your mentor do that? Rozier?
In the research that I had done, including Dr. Rozier, he has he speaks about this like on a YouTube channel and that kind of thing. And in the research that he's listed in, those were not listed. And I wasn't looking at it from that point of view. I'm looking at it from, like say with VTEs, you know, like, okay, is there, you know, in other words, am I going to adjust the therapy according to his PT or INR or PTT? No, I did not do that. Nor am I aware of those labs being routinely drawn for people on E2 therapy for metastatic prostate disease.
And that's what I was going to ask, is I did not read the articles that you referenced, but there was about 8. And so in those, I think we're all involving, well, mostly involving human subjects. And in those, did they demonstrate use of clotting studies, whether it's PTT, PTT? No.
Okay. Not that I recall.
Okay. What's the mechanism? How's the mechanism different besides between VTEs or other thromboembolic issues, transdermal versus oral versus parenteral routes of estradiol? You mentioned in your response.
Go ahead. E2 has shown benefit, you know, with an apoptotic process, both with BPH and prostate cancer. So that's the main mechanism, is apoptosis.
No. I mean, you mentioned that using transdermal E2 did not demonstrate generation or development of vascular thrombolic events or blood clots for FD, but it would with parenteral or oral route. I was under the impression that parenteral was the safest. I'm not particularly skilled in this area. I don't utilize it. I never have utilized it. I'm aware of the old DES, you know, studies, and I know that those were sort of canceled and fell out of favor due to lots of blood clotting. I know E2 is not DES, but you mentioned that transdermal is preferred because the IV form or the oral form were implicated in the development of blood clots. And I was wondering,
not IV, but PO estradiol, okay, because of the first pass effect increases blood clotting factors. But not, and I don't know why they didn't do it when the studies where they did parenteral or IV. I don't know why they did not, why they did it that route. I would have to look at the research again because that wasn't even on our mind, you know, to do IV. So I would have to look at that again to see if there was increased risk for VTE with IV. Not that I'm aware of. I think when you're given it transdermally, it's going in the bloodstream. So my supposition is that there'd be no, it's just the oral route only that would increase VTE.
Okay, because you stated here, it is important to note that while oral estradiol, in parentheses DES, and to a lesser extent parenteral estradiol, are significantly associated with vascular events, in parentheses blood clots, transdermal estradiol has been shown to not have those side effects.
Okay, sorry about that. Yeah, I did not. What could you tell me what page that's on, Dan?
Yeah, that is on page 4. First main pair, right under F, your example F.
Yeah, lesser extent. Well, that was.
I just didn't know the mechanism. I don't know
right.
if it's relevant.
I can't tell you why. That was just probably something that I'm reading one of the, you know, looking at one of the studies because I'm not having ever used parenteral E2. I can't comment.
Okay. I have a question about, in your write-up, on the same page, under MRIs of the prostate, A, 428-2020, there was, line 3 says, incidental thrombosis of his right greater sac in his vein, corresponding to findings on comparison Doppler ultrasound. That he wasn't your patient at the time, but
correct,
he was a year and a half later or so. And so
that
his last MRI was June of 21, 6 months before he presented to you. And then was there, when he presented, did you, I don't remember what you said to Dr. Satellite, but did you guys run a MRI to see, or any kind of scan given the increase in PSA to check for metastatic disease versus just extracapsular extension?
We were looking at what the old, you know, his other MR. I actually, let's see here. Yeah, this is one that was from 6/22 of 21, ordered from up in Rapid City, South Dakota. So that's what I was going by. I did not do any repeat imaging.
You know, I'm curious because, well, and you know, there was, and I don't know the reason why there was, but there was obviously a clot. I don't know how big it was in the saphenous. So I don't know if there's a predilection. I don't know all the history. I don't know what your clinical thinking was related to that. And you stated it here. You guys are given, I'm guessing, what's your, actually I should ask, when you give a 75 gram IV vitamin C or a 50 gram, what's your diluent solution and what rate are you using it at? Generally, not necessarily for the
treatment. Yeah, so we're looking for, you know, at least a 3 hour treatment, 3 to 4 hour treatment with sterile water. If we're doing 75, we're using 1,000. So we're letting out about 250. So we're starting with 750 approximately. I can look at my note here.
Which is about 1,200 to 1,300 milliosmoles, which we both know can be dehydrating, and especially with an extended 75 gram. I mean, giving it over 3 hours, even 4 hours, is better than giving it to somebody much faster. But I just start to think about blood rheology and hypercoagulability and not checking clotting labs and having there been, you know, this thrombosis seen on MRI. And for me, the picture's not super clear. And I didn't know if you, I mean, you obviously had seen that because you wrote it. So I didn't know in terms of clinical thinking. I'm curious why you didn't get any imaging upon presentation.
Well, you know, I've worked enough as a hospitalist to know that there's a lot of incidental, there's a lot of incidental venous thromboses that are, you know, clinically insignificant, you know, not DVT, more superficial. So that wasn't that necessarily concerning, especially since he didn't present with a lot of, you know, swelling.
To your knowledge, have you read the records from the hospital from his emergency room visit and his STEMI?
You know, I didn't get them until Gail sent the most recent one, and that's because I wasn't privy to that. So I have looked him over, you know, a couple days ago.
So, and you know, I'm not familiar with the case like you are, but there was a mention in there of CAD or coronary arterial disease. And I'm looking to you as the expert on the case, if they had suggested that that was pre-existing and that that was an incidental finding on his cardiac workup in the hospital, or if there was, or if that was just inferred because he had the MI. What's your comment on that?
I have that report in front of me here.
I'm going to have to locate it. So if you guys are after satellite, I might need a minute because I don't have that one on my screen. I got to go get it.
That's fine, Dr.
Okay.
Might be able to find it for you because I'm kind of not seeing it now.
Let's see. I know it was in part one and part two, and it was highlighted. Maybe not. It was somewhere near a highlight.
Dr. Sadlick, members of the board, this is Gail. Dr. McConnell got the investigative report. He did not get the additional records. What he did get was the discharge diagnosis on the investigative report is coronary artery disease chronic. It says chronic under there.
Yeah,
I'm not sure.
That's what I was getting at. I noticed it. So what I'm inferring from that or understanding as a practicing physician myself, that they're based on this finding in the hospital, they found chronic coronary arterial disease.
Correct. That was the discharge diagnosis.
What kind of testing? Oh, boy. Dr. Sadalek, you might be better.
Basically, I would imagine that I'm just reading through this now also.
I know. I'm trying to find it. I think it's on section two, if I remember.
Is it the 2D echo? Because that aortic cusp, I mean, that did, there was some mild, there was some valvular issues that I, you know, had noted here. Mild to moderate aortic valve regurge, aortic cusp appear mildly calcified.
Yes. So it says the LAD has a 95% proximal stenosis. The stenosis was stented with no residual stenosis post-stent deployment. Mild non-obstructive coronary artery disease or CAD otherwise. That's, I think, what we're getting at. That was a conclusion on, that was, I don't know what.
That would be the cath report then.
Okay. That was from
the catheter lab that he got.
Okay.
I got that. And then they also put him on Plavix for a year.
So, okay, yeah, there's a carotid artery duplex ultrasound bilaterally. And, okay, yeah, I mean, it does say indications of coronary artery disease. This isn't a big field of my expertise for FD. I am a board certified naturopathic oncologist, so prostate cancer is an area of my expertise. But I just didn't, I was going to maybe ask you, Dr. Sedelik, or other members of the board, what type of relevance you thought mild coronary artery disease as an incidental finding, which wasn't something he was, obviously, there was no indication to work him up for that previously, but with STEMI in the hospital, they did find that. And I don't know if that sort of is important.
Go ahead, I'm sorry, Dr.
Or I would put that question to Dr. McConnell, since it's your patient and you...
My response to Forrest was that, you know, in an email, and I didn't mean to be flippant about it, but the reality is there's a heart attack every 34 seconds. And CAD is not, while we'll read about the side effects of oral E2 for venous thromboembolism, you don't read of it creating heart disease in a matter of 2 weeks or over a month's period of time. We create heart disease over years' time. And so... that's the reason why that didn't even occur to me, like that I had created the problem. I look at coronary artery blockage as a years long process, and not something that isn't acute. And so I wanted to see, I was really wanting to see the cath report, you know, and so that's news to me that there was already, you know, mild coronary artery disease already noted, probably diffusely.
Is there any evidence that you're aware of that transdermal estradiol at therapeutic levels for the given indication for which you were treating FD can cause thromboembolic events?
Yes, it can. It's very low, and it's been, as I alluded to at the patch, it's similar to what's seen with ADP. And that was, you know, an omission on my part to discuss that with FD. So, and I'll own that.
But even despite the low potential incidence rate, you still weren't checking clot markers as a screening tool.
No, I don't typically check clot markers.
Are you talking to Dr. Rubin of him getting calcium score test on?
No, I asked if there was evidence that in the use of topical estradiol for the indication and the levels he was seeking, if there was any, you know, if there was evidence that they could cause blood clots, and he said yes.
Sure.
He didn't discuss it. And so I asked, well, why did you use that as a screening tool? And then he said, no, he doesn't do that routinely, and he didn't do it here. Right. And I guess I'm just curious why.
Which, are you talking about INR, PT, and PTT?
There's much, you and I know there's much more to blood clotting than just looking
right.
at stuff.
Right. I mean, right. Start, so in yeah. other words, get a carotid scan and like Dr. Sadler.
No, I mean, like for instance, it's standard for me to look at a prothrombin fragment 1.2 plasminogen activator inhibitor, fibrinogen activity, D-dimer, fibrinogen antigen routinely in my patients, mm-hmm. even somebody with prostate cancer. So, and a PTINR or PTT, which obviously are the most well recognized, looking at calcium, maybe factors or, but, and then we're talking about using, you know, very hypertonic IV therapy, which could cause dehydration, which could change the blood rheology, which could also stimulate tissue factor inside of it. So there's a lot there. And you answered the question that I was really looking at. And honestly, I think I may be done, except let me maybe one more question here. Was he on natokinase?
Yes, he was.
Okay. Who prescribed that?
I'm assuming it was Dr. Morris.
Okay. And Dr. McConnell, was he developing, how long was he on the estradiol under your care?
2 to 3 weeks.
Oh, got it. Okay. And then my question is, I don't have any more questions for you. Dr. Sadelick, I'm done. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Rubin.
Thank you.
Dr. Spatt, can I move up to you?
Yes, sir. Thank you. This is Dr. Spatt. Dr. McCallum, thank you for your time. Yeah. I just have a few questions to ask you in relating to what Dr. Rubin has just discussed. So when you do the transdermal estradiol, is there a protocol on what routine blood test you have to do on patients? If you could educate me on that, I appreciate it.
Yeah, so as has already been mentioned, we did my own research on this after listening to Dr. Rosier, and the goal of about 1,000 picomoles per liter, and 1 picomole per liter is equivalent to 0.232 picograms per mil, which is we typically measured in. So my goal for that would have been about double of what he was at. He was at 100 on his estradiol level, and so hence my reason for bumping the transdermal strength up for him. And I don't recall if he had started to take that or not in the timeline here, with that being said, the goal here is to be getting E2 levels probably every couple months to, and also PSA to dial that in, either back it off if we're getting too high, or and also to see what his response is to PSA. That was I think I alluded to that particular study. If you're interested, I could probably find out which one that is.
Okay. Now, earlier you mentioned that this is the second patient that you prescribe transdermal estradiol. Am I correct?
Yes.
Okay. So the other previous patient that you encounter, are they also have prostate cancer as well?
Yes, suspected. He's refusing biopsy.
Oh, so we don't know if the previous patient actually had prostate cancer being diagnosed by a urologist.
He doesn't see oncology.
Okay. So did you do your own test on him then?
I could have to look that up, see if I got an MRI on him. I believe we got an MR. For him.
Okay. So So this is the, do you have any other patient at the moment that you actually also prescribe transdermal estradiol?
Well, many patients, you know, women, of course, that we prescribe.
Okay, I mean men. I mean just, correct. You know, let's stick with the prostate cancer patient.
Yes, no, those are the only two, yes.
It's only two, yeah, okay, all right. And then would be, so you say a few months later you would probably do the blood test, the protocol that you mentioned earlier. Now, I just want to follow up with Dr. Rubin in that, like, especially with cancer patients, as you already know, they have tendency to end up having blood clots. So do you, I don't know what the, you know, I'm not expert in cancer like Dr. Rubin, but do you do routine blood tests like D-dimer and so forth with patients that you see, especially with like prostate cancer patient here? Do you often do them, or what's your protocol like?
I have this other patient, I have it on him in his chart now. We've recommended NATO kinase BID. And, you know, so we have ordered MRIs for him, but, so no, I do not routinely get those, clotting factors.
Okay. So let's go back to this particular case with Mr. FD. Did he ever complain to you if he was in pain, once he starts the estradiol, let's say a couple of days later, so far, did he complain to you any pain anywhere?
No.
You actually saw Mr. FD.
Let's see here.
Let me get. How many times did you actually see him? I noticed here you that was 9 IV.
Yes.
Giving correct. FD, but did you? Was that like no? That's
so,
9 times.
Yeah, I saw him on 3-3 and wrote a note. So that was my last note. The same, that was on March 3rd when he was getting ready to leave in a couple of weeks out of the state. And what he did at that point, he did, now that I'm looking at the note, his nipples were sore. The left one was, quote, hard. So he was, you know, that was after, you have to see when exactly I started him on okay. It.
Okay, let's stay with this conversation then. So when he mentioned to you that his nipple was tender and so forth, did you decrease the estradiol doses or you keep him at the same doses?
Well, my goal would have, you know, I don't know, my note doesn't mention, you know, evening primrose oil, but that could sometimes help. That definitely helps women with sore nipples or breath. But at this point, my goal was to start to see if, you know, we can get the PSA trending downward. That would be my goal.
Okay.
And so we could be efficacious with the treatment. And then, but if it got to the point, it wasn't like he was necessarily, you know, asking for it to go down. And I don't know if that was, you know, they're just slightly sore, so it sounds like it was he was tolerating the estradiol fairly well.
Okay, so he didn't mention anything else besides the nipple being tender, and that's pretty much it.
That's correct.
What was your conversation with him? Right. Okay.
Well,
so
he was having.
Yeah, go ahead. Sorry.
Well, he was having some urinary issues too, and so we prescribed some catheters in case he got behind the eight ball and so he could do that and recommended follow-up with urology. But I don't think that was related to the E2 therapy.
Okay, I got you. Okay. And then when you received the email that your front desk was telling you that they missed on it, when you respond back to FD, did he respond back to you? Or did you talk to him after? Were they able to contact him? And how was the conversation though?
I gave him my cell number to call, and if I recall right, he got back to me within a few days, rather keep it by email, and which is fine because we have a documented what's going on. But I gave him I was willing to visit with him, and obviously that was just a very unfortunate. You know what I'm saying? Like, we're very responsive usually when patients reach out to us.
Okay. And did you explain to him, to Mr. FD, what's going on and why? Any idea? Did he understand what you explained to him and so forth?
Regarding, I think, you know, from FD's perspective, that the transdermal estradiol, you know, was causative. And, you know, I explained to him that temporality doesn't, you know, mean causality. And that his next email was, I think, pretty much like, hey, you know, can you, you know, you're responsible for this. What can you do for me financially?
Okay, all right. Well, thank you. That's all I have, Dr.
Stiles. Thanks, Dr. Spatt. Dr. Campbell, can I roll up to you?
Oh, thank you. Can you guys hear me okay? I was having an issue with my cell phone here. Dr. McConnell, can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Very good, sir. I'd like to ask just a couple of questions about your patient's history. If you could scroll down to the patient's physical characteristics and family history.
Okay. Okay.
Now, with respect to the patient's history, did the patient indicate that either he was a smoker or that he had any family history of heart disease or stroke?
Former smoker is what I had listed here, and I know that there were some things that the FD and his wife sent some errata based on things, because we sent records to them, and so normally I would put down when they stopped smoking. So I do have it listed there. I don't know how long he had smoked, but I have him as a former smoker. He walks for exercise, denies alcohol. No family history as far as his mother and father. They both died in older age and not from CAD.
And what was his blood pressures on his visits?
Initial blood pressure 141 over 79. Okay. They're 155 over 85. This is on January 17th.
And is he taking any high blood pressure medication?
Not that I'm aware of. No history of hypertension.
Hyperlipidemia.
His LDL is quite high.
Okay. And I haven't seen the patient, don't know his weight. Would he be considered obese in any way?
No. No, BMI was 21.8-ish. I think he had been losing weight.
Okay. Dr. Rosier, did Dr. Rosier, when he was going over, you know, his general recommendation that you followed, did he talk about any risk factors to look for in patients that you would be doing, you know, any type of hormonal therapy associated treatment?
This was more of this wasn't the main purpose of his talk. He's obviously a hormone replacement therapy specialist. And knows the research very well, but he's a very convincing presenter and very knowledgeable about research. And so I put confidence in him and his teachings. I've considered doing some of his trainings as well. So from there, I pretty much took it from there to do my own research. And so I don't, you know, I don't, we don't have a lot of, I mean, it has history, right? It was used even allopathically, but there, you know, I think for it to, you know, it's probably fallen out of favor in that, you know, there's drugs and the drug companies, there's this push, you know, to push certain medications. And so for that, that's the reason why I could see this falling out of favor. But as far as comparing it to Lupron and Cathodex and some of those drugs, I mean, that was the thing that Dr. Rosier was mentioning, is that you don't get the same side effects that you would from these androgen deprivation therapies that are mainstream.
I mean, typically the research shows that if they have two or more cardiovascular risk factors, which this patient happens to have high blood pressure and high cholesterol, he did smoke, you know, not actively smoking, but did smoke, you know, hormonal therapy associated increase in CVD risk was highest in people who already had heart disease or that who met two or more of those risk factors. And so I was kind of concerned about that.
Well, I'm not putting him in the hypertensive category. Patients often, you know, have a blood pressure that's a little higher because of white coat syndrome. And so I would not give him the diagnosis of hypertension. Just lipidemia, yeah.
All right. I appreciate your time, sir. And Mr. Chairman, I don't have any other questions at this time.
Okay. Thank you, Dr. Campbell. Is Ms. Gallen on the line? No. Ms. Tibbetts.
I just have two clarifying questions. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah.
Okay. How long between when he started the estrogen, estradiol, and when he had his heart attack? How many weeks was that?
I prescribed the, let's see here. Hang on 1 second. I'm just trying to find that. Okay. Bear with me. I apologize. Thought it was in my report, but it's in. Here we go. Sorry. Okay. On 3-3, January 31st. January 31st.
Nope.
Is when I called it in. So I'm assuming a few days after that is when.
Yep, 127.
I'll take that back. January. January 13th is when I called in the E2, and then his heart attack was in the last part. Was it the 27th? I think it was the latter part of the event was in the last part of January, so it had been two to three weeks, a little over 2 weeks.
Okay. And I heard the names of other doctors. Is it in the record how many different doctors he was seeing during the same period of time?
To my knowledge, only Dr. Morris and myself.
Okay. Thank you. Those are my only questions.
ahead, board members. Let's hear from the complainant,
FDA. Wait, Dr. Sadler, this is Dr. Rubin. I have one more question. I know we get to circle back, but before you, can I ask Dr. McConnell?
Sure.
No.
Yeah.
Dr. McConnell, a good point was just brought up. I forgot who was just talking, but I think it was Karen. She asked if FD was seeing other doctors concomitantly with you. And do you recall if during the time that FD was taking the estradiol, or from the time that you saw him to the time of the incident for which you went to the emergency room, was he getting IVs at Dr. Morris's as well?
Yes, to my knowledge, Dr. Morris is doing some of the phosphatidylcholine with essential oils, according to what the patient reported.
Got it. Okay, that's my last question. I appreciate it. Thank you. Thanks, Dr. Sadler.
Dr. McConnell, before I get FD going here, when I went through this, there's Garinell and Morris. So were they also kind of treating and doing things too?
Well, you see, saw Dr. Yarnell in a teleconference, my understanding, and Dr. Yarnell then faxed over a protocol for the high dose IVC, and okay. So we went from there, and we're also particular about every time to use blood glucose as a surrogate marker for even though we did the first few treatment, we got serum values for his vitamin C,
right,
and to see if they were adequate. But after that, we were using blood glucose as a surrogate marker.
Okay, and you're looking whether he was getting hypo or hyperglycemic?
Well, to reach the therapeutic level of vitamin C, whether we're going to go with 75 gram, and it appeared that 50s were working fine, so we kind of stuck with that.
Okay, got it. FD, are you still on the line?
I am.
Can you, we've gone through, you've heard the case. Can you give us some more input?
Absolutely. We're trying not to get too excited about it. From a laity point of view, you guys speak another language to some degree that but we followed along with it. And we have a few clarifications and corrections to what Dr. McConnell said, as well as just history that can hopefully clear things up a little bit. I do have a statement to read, but I think I'd probably like to go through some of those particulars that we need to clarify with regarding non-smoking. I was never a smoker. I don't know how that even got in the chart, but that was one of the things that we addressed with his records to make amendments to. Let's see. Dr. Garnell was a conference consultant I had from Washington, and as he stated, he was, prescribed 75 grams or prescribed a blood glucose level of 350 or more in order to have effectiveness of the infusions, and he wrote that protocol so that we could get it started. We needed to go to Arizona. We're snowbirds, and it was getting cold, so we needed to go south. I had been taking natto off and on quite a bit before that, just by our own research and finding out that it was beneficial for veins and other health issues that I had. And Dr. Yarnell, recommended a little bit higher dosage than that I had been taking. We went to Arizona in order to try to get the vitamin C protocols going as much as we could. My wife found Dr. McConnell's clinic online and did some research, and they knew each other from past school histories or whatever. So he was willing to start those infusions. We could not get a start of service, beginning of service with him until January 13th was the first appointment we had. But we started them actually mid-December. And Nature Cure Clinic was going to be closed over the Christmas holiday, and we'd already started, and we wanted to maintain those. That's how Dr. Morris came into the picture. We found him be willing to administer those infusions as well so that we didn't miss out. We're trying to maintain some continuity there. So that's how we got to know Dr. Morris, and we continue to consult with him a little bit here and there. We had infrequent infusions of different kinds with him, that methylene blue and ozone and essential oils, as well as some other vitamin C. So we, we're kind of using both naturopaths at the same time if we could. Not that we didn't really have that many because it was a much longer drive for us. Our RV was down in Green Valley area, so it was actually a lot easier to stay with Dr. McConnell's clinic. The day of the heart attack was actually March 18th. Dr. McConnell prescribed the estrogen earlier, but I didn't actually start it until the 26th of January. And I ended it on 3-3 right after our last consult when he talked about raising the amount up to get that target number that he wanted. And I was not just feeling the sensitivity in the nipples. I just felt cognitively off and emotionally off. And I recognized it as very similar to the ADT shot in its effect on me. Dr. McConnell had told us pretty clearly that we wouldn't have the same symptoms as the ADT, that testosterone would not drop and the other side effects would not be present. My testosterone dropped 220 points, and I definitely had all the other side effects, though not as severe as the ADT shot was. So that's kind of wanted to clarify that. The day of the heart attack, my wife called Dr. McConnell's office from the ER and mentioned it to them at the desk. And we later conferred and asked them if Dr. McConnell had received that message, and they said yes, he had, on the day of. So that was kind of surprising that we hadn't heard. When we did finally hear from him, it was actually at our instigation that we sent an email saying, did you know about this? And then that was the email that I lost in his office there somewhere. So as far as waivers about the risk and everything, there was never anything regarding that. That the risk was not elaborated to us at all about he said there was minimal risk. It was kind of dismissive, and it's actually, I think we were standing up and ending the office visit at that time. So we are, I think that's the main parts of what I needed to clarify, that it was not and the other thing was that the cardiologist, three cardiologists that I've seen now, that one in the hospital, two was the attending surgeon, put the stent in, as well as the follow-up up here in Idaho, where we are now. There was a cardiologist in Washington, Spokane, Washington, that I saw, and they all said that though there might have been that plaque and the other heart disease present, that most likely the estrogen was the trigger. And that's from the three allopaths, and another naturopath said that as well. So, and that was after reviewing the records as best they had. So, I'm not sure. Do you want to address those and ask the questions, or do you want my little statement? I have a 2.5-minute statement I'd like to read, but I'll let you guys decide the full protocol for that.
I just a real quick few questions for you, then I'm going to have you read your statement.
Sure.
What is your current age?
69, or I'll be 69 on Saturday.
Okay. Congratulations on the birthday coming up. What is were you a prior smoker, occupationally, anything like that transpiring in your life?
No, not at all. I was in construction, so there were solvents and things I was exposed to on occasion, but not typically, construction has different kind of cleaners and preservatives and stuff, but my parents never smoked. I never smoked. I'm not sure how that got in the record that I was a smoker.
And then your LAD, was that found on a calcium score test through your cardiologist a couple years ago?
No.
Were you aware of that? Okay.
I never saw a cardiologist before the heart attack.
Okay. All right. And then go ahead. You had a statement you want to read the board?
I do. It's about 2.5 minutes, I think. I'll try to be succinct with that. But basically, thank you for your time. We appreciate your concerns, taking our concerns seriously. I'd like to especially thank Gail Anthony for her amazing help. We trust you'll come to a fair and accurate conclusion. Though I believe Dr. McConnell is sincerely trying to help, his lack of experience with this particular high-dose estrogen therapy and the protocols for it set me on a course for disaster. We feel strongly that there should have been a comprehensive evaluation of my heart, arteries, and blood clotting factors before this therapy was implemented, as well as a much clearer disclosure of the risk. We wanted to find something that would make a difference. Dr. McConnell's confidence sold us on it. When we asked about other testing, he insisted that monitoring of PSA and hormone levels was all that he would do. Over the last 2 years, we've spent over $30,000 on naturopathic therapies and related expenses trying to get some positive response against my prostate cancer. About $6,000 of that was paid to Nature Cure Clinic for their services. Best results at the end of my time there were not good enough to continue the biweekly infusions. Plus, we just did not have the funds to continue. My plan was to return to work for the summer, trying to make enough to restart some PC therapies and recharge our finances. That plan is now on hold. Instead, we have new burdens, both financial and medical. These concerns make it harder to focus on cancer treatment. We are working with all parties concerned to get some help with our portion of the approximately $140,000 in costs. Projected future expenses are also significant. I'm physically unable to take a job right now. The daily fatigue and weakness prevents me from taking steady employment. The road to recovery for this heart attack is not short. The financial recovery will be longer. At today's gas prices, even a 45-minute drive for biweekly cardiac rehab is expensive. Though I'm walking as much as possible, the blood thinners and fatigue also hinder my ability to exercise, something that I know will help with both cancer and heart recovery. This heart attack has dramatically affected every aspect of my family's life, physical, financial, and emotional. It has likely shortened my life. So thanks for listening.
Thank you.
Yeah.
So, board members, let's discuss what we would like, how we'd like to proceed from this point.
Dr. Sedlak, this is Dr. Rubin. May I ask the complainant or FD a question?
Yeah, please.
Hi, FD. This is Dr. Dan Rubin. I just want to go over one more time. You were on the estradiol transdermal patch from Dr. McConnell from January 26th of this year through March 3rd of this year, correct?
It was a cream applied to my skin.
Oh, cream, okay.
Those dates are correct.
Okay. And then 15 days later is when the incident happened that landed you in the hospital. That's a heart attack.
That's correct, yes. Okay. We were camping with our RV way out in the middle of nowhere. So it was a struggle. I actually drove myself to Stafford.
Wow. Upon looking at I need to ask you, were you also on vitamin K?
No.
Okay. At the time, you were not on vitamin K.
That's correct. I was taking the natokinase, we have a long list of supplements I was taking, but that was the natokinase, but I guess would be more significant, one of those.
Well, because the only list that I have was from 126-22, and vitamin K every other day was listed. This is from Dr. Morris's chart.
Yeah, I'm not sure where Dr. Morris got that. We did, I think before that, we probably submitted a list of supplements that I was taking before that, and it's quite possible that that was on that list. At the time, I don't think I'd been taking it since fall of 21.
Dr. Yarnell intimated that it was not a good thing to continue.
Yeah, Dr. Yarnell had basically told us that it was probably not a good thing.
Okay. It looks like it was, I don't know who typed it up, but the handwritten date was 1/26/22. The typed date was January 10th of 22. And so somewhere you stopped taking it. And then do you recall the last infusion of essential oils that you received prior to the heart attack?
I only received one essential oil from Dr. Morris, and my wife is looking up the records of that right now.
I believe it was on January 26th, but I'm not sure. But, I mean, you did have one on that.
That's correct. That's the only time I had it.
Okay.
And, I didn't start the actual estrogen until the 26th because I was just holding back on it. I'd already filled the prescription for it, and I think I was waiting to consult Dr. Morris. He was about that therapy help, and he was a little hesitant, but thought that it might be okay. But,
and were you also around that time with the heart attack taking fenbendazole?
No, I stopped with that just because it had run out, and I had run into some high liver enzymes when I was earlier in the summer, or late at the end of the summer, I'd had some blood work done, and my liver enzymes were high. That could have pointed to the possible cause, so we just cut it off at that point.
Fair enough. Exactly. Okay. Thank you, FD.
Thank you.
I'm done, Dr. Sandler.
FD, do you know, I know your wife's checking through her records real quick, but do you have any idea what essential oil Dr. Morris utilized?
He had a list of 8 of them. There was frankincense, myrrh, tea tree oil, Italian chrysanthemum, and we didn't actually get the whole list, but she's got it somewhere else. So,
Dr. Sadalek, I have that list if you want me. I can read it. Melaleuca, helichrysum, boswellia, commiflora, bergamot. Oh, okay. You have it. Okay.
No. Go ahead, Dr. Rubin. Go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry. So melaleuca, tea tree, helichrysum, gibberellus chrysanthemum, boswellia, commiflora, which I believe is myrrh, bergamot, which is bergamot, ravintsara, I don't know. Looks like curcuma and copaiba. I believe copaiba is it's a plant. I know it's copaiba oil. I mean, it just is what it is.
Yeah.
So there's quite a few of those, which we can obviously talk about later. But it looks like on 112 and 126 with those IV therapies, doctor. Those are the records with the record show.
Dr. Rubin, since you deal with more of the oncology perspective, do you know if those are all like intermixed in an injectable vial you get from Olympia, or do you have any idea?
To my knowledge, the order from his clinic says add 1 cc of each to D5W400, artemisinin 2 mLs, and that was it. And it looks like they drifted over 3 hours, so no indication, but I've never seen those come from an FDA-approved compounding pharmacy, correct.
Okay.
Can I interject something? Dr. Morris basically mentioned he has, I think he's probably one of the only people that has access to somebody who can emulsify these oils to the point where they are infusible.
Well, I think the phosphatidylcholine is the emulsification agent.
Okay. That's the other language I don't speak.
Understood. So,
okay.
Dr. Sadalek,
go ahead.
Well, there's a lot here. The testimonies have been great. I certainly I certainly understand that Dr. McConnell is dual certified or holds dual licensure, has worked as a hospitalist. Can't work as a hospitalist and not understand acute care and, convalescence of people in an acute setting. And so, these dates of the estradiol were new to me, and so I just quickly did the calculation. According to UpToDate and the internet and my databases, the half-life of estradiol, 37 and a half hours. If you multiply that by 4, you get less than 7 days. There was a 15-day lapse from 3.3 to 3.18. So that was one thing. I mean, so I don't know what happens when you raise estradiol levels and then they come down because you withdraw. I'm not familiar with that type of therapy. And so we might want to throw that question back to Dr. McConnell, but it looks like, you know, that went through more than, that was about 8.5 half-lives,
right.
Which means that the estradiol was well out of the body and probably even sooner than that, but that was just, you know, the terminal half-life. So that was one thing that I was looking at. And now I know that we have the saphenous vein issue, and so potential predilection towards clotting. There wasn't a workup by Dr. McConnell clot-wise. Dr. Campbell went through and really interviewed regarding vitals and some of the blood chemistries, which I think is relevant, but a lot of people are walking around with that. There is the high-dose vitamin C issue and, you know, changing the rheology of blood. But for me right now, most provocative would be that the half-life of the estradiol cream and the termination of the treatment 15 days prior to the incident. So I just wanted to kind of put that on the table. So it's difficult for me right now to find an actual connection between the estradiol and the heart attack. And there's other variables here. One big thing is I have no idea what IV essential oils do in the body, especially resinous ones, if they stick around, how they interact with the blood vessels, the interstitium,
sure.
Whether they can cause tissue factor. Do they enhance clotting factors? I don't know. I don't know. I mean, I simply don't know. You know, there are some medications that stick around in the body for, you know, a year, like Prolia, or 6 months. I mean, they're specially formulated, but a lot of those have lipid coatings, and these essential oils are involved, I believe, with lipids. And so they may have long half-lives, and I don't know how they interact. So it's difficult for me right now as a practicing physician and knowing what I know to blame this on top cholesterol. There's a lot of variables here. So open for discussion.
Is it okay if my wife chimes in on that subject a little bit?
Have her hold for a moment because Dr. Rubin just said a statement, so I need to roll through my board members. Let me roll up to Dr. Spatt, and then we'll turn to your wife real quick. Dr. Spatt.
Thank you.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. Mr. Epstein, I just want to bring this up. Before you went to speak up the nail, you went to see a urologist. Who actually diagnosed you with having prostate cancer?
I had a workup in southern Arizona in the spring of 2020, and high PSA sent me to a urologist who did a DRE and determined that I had it. He sent me for an MRI in Tucson where they noticed where the problem was visual. We were getting ready to hit the road again, so we actually went up to northern Idaho. I found a urologist by referral from a friend, and he determined the same thing, did a prostate biopsy and determined that level of, and the bone scan. We were looking for metastasis to the bones, and there was none at that time. And it was originally diagnosed in Idaho and with Gleason scores of 8.
Okay, what did they recommend? What did the urologist, what did they recommend you to do at that point?
He was recommending immediate prostatectomy. He was radical prostatectomy. I was a little hesitant to that as we read our own research on side effects and long-term recovery. We also looked to Seattle Cancer Care in terms of radiation with proton beam and consulted with a radiology oncologist in Spokane, Washington. And we were just about to go that route towards radiation. I went ahead and taken the ADT shot as per her recommendation, administered through Dr. Clark's office, the North Idaho urologist. And at that point, I made this sudden turn of direction to go try to go natural with the whole process. It was a little too late to deal with the with ADT, but that was installed already, and it didn't really wear off until February the following year.
Okay, so was this the Yanel, the first NASH spot that you see, or have you seen someone else, some other NASH spot before you start up the Yanel?
Yes, Dr. Nell was the first one I could find that would consult with me about the subject. It was a teleconference, video call, and conferred with him a couple times. It was a very, very busy practice, and I had trouble connecting with him. I did get tell him what I was planning on to go to try to keep doing the vitamin C therapies, because we've read a lot about that. And he wrote the script for, or the protocol, for me to be able to receive that in multiple places. I have a boutique IV store up here that was willing to do that same dosage of vitamin C if I had something from doctors stating that that level was safe for me.
Oh, okay. Okay. All right. So that's all I have, Dr. Ballard. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Dr.
Baff.
Dr. Campbell, can I roll up to you?
So, I mean, ultimately, you know, our patient here, how would you see this situation best handled? What are you hoping for as a result of today?
I'm not sure. You know, we basically, you know, we're trying to get some kind of financial recovery because it hit so hard to us. To a burden. I'm, you know, retired on a pretty, I was self-employed, so I have pretty low Social Security, and Medicare only covers so much. So to get hit with the co-pays with all the two hospitals and a helicopter ride, plus the ongoing therapies from now on, you know, to have those, we just need some help, is basically. And I'm not trying to extract, you know, vindictively or anything. I'm not trying to get emotional pain and everything. I just need some help covering our costs of dealing with this. Again, we're not vindictive people. I told Dr. McConnell in one of the emails, you know, I'll forgive, and too expensive for me to not forgive. But I wanted, I guess I was hoping for him to admit that there was a mistake made in prescribing that. I think that was just something, you know, that we needed to hear, that he was sorry about. Not that he was sorry that it happened, but that sorry that he did something that could have likely triggered it.
Because at the beginning you were talking about how you did, you know, you believe that his heart was in the right place. Then is that still true?
Yeah. I don't think he's a bad man. I don't think he was trying to do something that he didn't have some level of confidence about. It's just that in retrospect for us, looking back at our conversations with him, he was using anecdotal and one other patient, and that he was thinking that he would take Dr. Rozier's course. But, you know, looking back at it now, I go, well, why didn't you do that before we started the therapy, so that we could be sure that all those risk factors were, you know, well known and watched over.
All right, thank you. Dr. McConnell, are you, what's your position on all this? Are you wanting the board to disposition this on your behalf, or is there something that you have to, you know, is there anything that on your end that after hearing what he had to say that you want to come across with, or?
Well, not anything necessarily new. I think all of us can say that the last thing we want to do is to hurt somebody. I see this as an emerging therapy, and the piece that would be valuable for me, which you guys have already covered, is, you know, are there going to be some patients who are candidates for this or not based on coagulable factors, etc.
And I see this as a viable therapy and not causative of an acute MI. So I don't see that I have responsibility from that perspective of doing a therapy. Like I said, I have several patients with estrogen levels of 100 guys that are on, you know, testosterone replacement therapy. And so their estrogen goes up. And I don't, you may be aware that no longer do we get aggressive with aromatase inhibitors because we're doing more harm, and we allow a man to have higher estrogen levels as long as he's not getting side effects, as in gynecomastia. And I'm sympathetic toward FD's and his wife's situation at this time. And, but I don't see that I'm responsible for his heart attack.
Thank you. And do you feel, that the patient is due any type of refund, whether it be $0 all the way up to the exact amount spent in your clinic?
I really don't. We gave him the therapy, and we didn't cause any harm from the IVs. I'm looking at Dr. Yarnell's recommendation of something that we may not have included. But he's generally recommending, you know, staying above 350 milligrams per deciliter for vitamin, for blood sugars to keep it high like that. We tried to do what we could to minimize and bring it down to 50 grams, which we saw efficacy. And so there would be a cost savings there. I mean, all these therapies, as all of us know, we have, you know, you're outside of insurance coverage, and this is a choice we need. This is a choice we're making.
All right. Thank you. Mr. Chairman, I don't have anything else.
Thank you, Dr. Campbell. Ms. Tippett?
I don't have any further questions or comments.
And, FDE, I said that we would let your wife speak for a moment, but then we'll have to quote wrap up this case.
Okay, thank you. Here she is.
Okay, this is Laura's wife, and my question would be for Dr. Rubin, and some of the things he said gave me some important thoughts, and I hope you'll listen for a minute. Dr. Rubin, you said that you looked up the half-life of the estradiol, and that it probably would have gone out of Forrest's body 15 days before the heart attack. Well, I also would like to know, is that estradiol at that high a dose? What is the comparison with the dose? And he terminated the estrogen therapy on 3-3, so that would have been the last. And then, yes, 15 days later was the heart attack. But I assuming that there was some residual effect of the estrogen in his blood, and that may have affected this. And my other question would be, why then might the cardiologist, in your opinion, state that the estradiol was a trigger? And then I have another comment about Dr. Rozier after that. If you want to respond to that, fine. If not, that's fine. But I do have that concern about the estradiol remaining in Forrest's body and still a plausible factor in the heart attack, especially with the opinion of the cardiologist.
Dr. Selig, may I answer?
Yeah, Dr. Rubin, you know, briefly just answer because you had the map.
Thank you. No, that's a great point, and point taken that if estradiol maybe was at fault for the blood clot, then during the month or 5 weeks or so when it was being employed, even though it was still subtherapeutic levels, perhaps a clot could have formed then, which would be regardless of withdrawal of the estrogen therapy and it getting out of the body. It's a great point, and we don't know. But it really does, and there was another one. Oh, and then, yes, in terms of it getting out of the body, even if it was at higher levels. So, you know, when we talk about half-lives, that's the term medically for how long it takes something, like when you take a drug, how long does it get out of the body? Or, you know, when it's produced in the body, like in the term, in the case of estradiol, you were constantly producing it because it degrades and goes away. And so the measured, it was 37 hours. So that's like the maximum. So some people could get rid of it in 20 hours. So the maximum it would take would be 37 hours. And then we, from a pharmacy perspective, multiply that by 4, which is where I got just over 6 days. And so, yeah, and I don't know what happened in that time. There's so many confounding factors, but as a comment, it's a very good point. Why would that hospitalist say it could be estrogen? I would, as a practicing physician for 25 years, and Dr. Sadelike, you may want to dig into this, but I would think that the hospital or the emergency room doctor doesn't know the data at all on topical estradiol and, you know, for this and those blood levels or any modern data. And so it might have been an assumption. It might have been in passing, and it's not something that I would take as true. And that would be something that would need to be sorted out, not here. That to me doesn't have any bearing because that's not the field of medicine. Unless we saw something in the notes that say, you know, we see this routinely, with, you know, and they didn't even run an estradiol level. So, I don't know. That might have been from old data, and the preponderance with DES orally taken was that it did cause blood clots. And I don't know the age of the doctor. I don't know where they were trained. So I can't bring that into this, but it's a good point.
Dr. Ubin, most likely what I would pontificate with the ED or ER doc was that he might have been just going from BCP, birth control, phenotype pill.
It wasn't the ER doctor. Excuse me, it wasn't the ER doctor. It was three cardiologists.
Okay. So, I mean,
And the question being more, not so much whether his estrogen left over, is what was the leftover effect of that estrogen?
Sure. And you know the way I kind of see it, and I'm gonna then ask the board members to come up with a motion on, is this is kind of a trifecta of issues, age, obviously, you know, you did have unfortunately to realize that cardiovascular disease. Dr. McConnell, I think probably gets the point that if you're going to do these therapies, that you obviously, run, like Dr. Ruben elaborated on, about an hour ago, run D-dimers, run PT, you know, PT, PTP. If in question, do a calcium score test. There's, you know, less than $200. And then you're totally covered, you know, preventatively. So some of this, you know, could possibly have been avoided. I don't know totally. And we don't know what Morris is at, you know, parts of this were either. So with all that being said, Dr. Campbell has some good stuff also. I'm going to kind of let the board members decide which way they'd like to go with this.
I'd like one more statement, and then it's about Dr. Rozier's research, which was the main research that Dr. McConnell used. Dr. McConnell, to his credit, encouraged us to watch the videos, and I couldn't get them totally, they wouldn't come through all the way, but I did read the written research, and I would encourage the board members to look at those videos and read the research. To me, it was not fully valid research, but at least the things that he gave to me. It was over 6 weeks. It didn't even say the number of respondents. And it was very, very weak. And so I compared this research to other research, particularly life extension research. And the conclusion of the life extension was that estrogen needs to be balanced with the other hormones. And so that's why it was little curious to me that someone who does hormone balancing didn't take that into consideration, maybe did not take that into consideration. So I would compare Dr. Rozier's research with other research on this subject of high dose and increasing high dose research, because we think that had Forrest, had he continued Dr. McConnell's recommendations to go up 2 more clicks of this high dose estrogen, he would not be speaking to you today. And that's all I have.
Okay. Thank you. Yeah, I'm going to add this phase. I need to put it that, get my board members to help draw closure to this today. So the options we would have is move it to formal interview. The other option we have is for a letter of concern based on whatever the board feels. The other would be a dismissal or consent agreement. So I need the feedback of my board members.
This is Dr. Rubin. I'm prepared to make a statement. In my opinion, there are confounding variables here. The preponderance of data suggests that transdermal estradiol is not thrombogenic. The other health issues that were discovered during the workup and the other treatments that the doctors were giving, I don't see that there was fault here. And I think that maybe, you know, some of the goals might be better recovered with a civil suit. But in terms of the board here, I don't see a need for a consent agreement. I don't see a need to move it to formal interview. I don't see grounds for a letter of concern. I think what you said in terms of Dr. McConnell got, you know, the point. I would move for dismissal. I move for dismissal. I make a motion to dismiss the case based on my statement.
Okay. So, thank you, Dr. Rubin. Let me move off for Dr. Spath and Campbell and Ms. Tibbetts and get their viewpoints real quick. Your motion has been made. I just want to go into a quick discussion on your motion. Dr. Spath?
Yeah, this is Spath. Yeah, you know, this case is a little bit more complex than I expected. And, you know, by saying that, you know, there's no way that I would be able to tell the transdermal estradiol was caused because during the findings, thing happened and your heart attack happened too. And so, I still in the dilemma of trying to see what other, which way I would persuade, if you could move to the Theodopa Campbell, let me think about it and then you can recycle back to me on it.
Okay. Dr. Campbell, your thought process?
I definitely see both sides, 100%. You know, when you move everything else aside and focus on what it is that our board is responsible to accomplish, it's overall public safety, you know, and making sure that if mistakes happen, they're not repeated again, and making sure that we follow that objective. With regard to punitive damages, it's our responsibility to judge the evidence that's put in front of us today. And while we have verbal testimony that talks about 3 cardiologists and their opinion regarding causation, we don't have statements. We don't have any evidence that would allow us to weigh out all the differentiating facts. And of course, if there was another case similar to this that Dr. McConnell had, then we could use that case to lead cooperation to this case, but we don't have that either. And so with that being said, I would also support Dr. Rubin's statement to dismiss the case.
Dr. Campbell.
Just to clarify, Dr. Campbell, was that a second?
You know, provided that no other board members have anything else to add, different opinion, then yes, it would be a second. Thank you.
Ms. Tibbetts, let me roll to you real quick, and I'm going to finish up with Dr. Stat. Your thought process on, it sounds like you got a couple motions out there.
I support Dr. Rubin's motion to dismiss.
Can I roll down to you?
Yeah, you know, I guess this just needs more information, Dr. Rubin was saying too. So, I will go along with the dismissing the case for Dr. McConnell.
And my thoughts are, you know, Dr. McConnell, I guess from this point on, make sure that you have waivers that state anything and everything from PIA to MI, et cetera, to deep thrombosis. And then do your, like Dr. Rubin brought up at the beginning, do your laboratory serology offer calcium score test. Go from a different perspective with this. The problem that I come up with, and as I said earlier, I think it's kind of a trifecta of unfortunate issues for FD and also FD's spouse. And as a chairperson, I'm sorry that this happened to FD and spouse. The second's been made by Dr. Campbell. So, Ms. Anthony, do you want to do roll call?
Yes. Dr. Sadlick?
Aye.
Ms. Tibbetts?
Aye.
Dr. Campbell?
Aye.
Dr. Spatt?
Aye.
Dr. Rubin?
Aye.
Motion carries.
Okay, with 1:48, and I make a motion for a 5-minute quick recess. And we'll meet back.
This is Dr. Rubin, I second that.
See you guys in about 5 minutes. Thanks.